One, two. Okay, it works. Okay, so what we're going to do today is something a lot closer to stuff you know or think you know, because you use it every day. So I want to talk about graphical interaction. Graphical interaction is interaction when you have pictures on the screen and you use typically an input device, which can be a mouse, a trackpad, a joystick, or some game controller, or of course direct touch to have direct access to the content on the screen. And just to remind you, I introduced direct manipulation, right? When we talked about what I called what? Interaction? I gave you a list of interaction. Style, yes. Okay. Early morning. So direct manipulation is an interaction style, and today it's the dominant interaction style on your laptops, on your smartphones, and tablets, on touch screens to get tickets in the train station, or I don't know. So the principles of direct manipulation, I think, is something that should be sort of welded into your brain. Continuous representation of the objects of interest. We want to see the stuff we interact with. And for every principle, you can ask yourself, is it the case that in this particular interface, the thing I'm interacting with are actually visible? Physical actions instead of complex syntax. So the physical actions, of course, and we'll see that in detail, is things like tapping or clicking, etc. But the second part, complex syntax, is important. Originally, this came up as a way to distinguish graphical user interfaces from the interfaces that were most common at the time, which uses command line. So you needed to know the syntax to enter the command, right? But as I will show in a second, even in graphical user interaction, you can also have a complex syntax where you have to click there and do things in a certain order. So just the fact that you are tapping and clicking does not mean that you're following this principle. The third one is rapid, incremental, reversible actions whose effects on the objects of interest, which are the things defined in the point one, are immediately visible. We want to create this notion that you're physically interacting with the thing on the screen, even though we know it's all pixels and the real objects are somewhere in the computer. We want to give the impression that when I click that icon and move it, it's really an object that I'm taking on, like on the desk and moving to the trash. So rapid, okay? Incremental means as you do something, you get feedback about what you're doing. And reversible, that's something that digital technology allows us to do, that things are, in general, easy to undo. And we want actions to be reversible because we learn by doing, and we learn by making mistakes, making errors, and by failing. So if you know that anything you do can be undone, you're more likely to explore things and to try things out and discover features than if you are afraid of breaking something every time you click somewhere. And the last rule here is about the layered approach to discover the interface progressively. And the idea is that you want someone who is not familiar with the system, we usually call them novices, to be able to become an expert by using the system and not by having to read a manual or take training classes or whatever. So that means that you need to have simple things to be simple to do, but more powerful things to be possible as well. And that's a topic we'll come back to later on. So this all, this seems pretty, to say, obvious, or we're used to the idea that we are interacting with things on the screen which look like real objects. But I think in practice we're not really doing very much direct manipulation. I think it's a lot if you try to deconstruct the interactions that you use on everyday tasks. You'll find that oftentimes for a simple task like changing the size of this object on the screen, this piece of text, I have to first select the object. So selecting is direct enough. I mean, I touch it, select it, okay? But then what? In many systems, I have to go to a menu bar, find a command in the menu. If I'm an expert, I may know the shortcut. But the shortcut is also something I need to memorize, and I would say that qualifies as complex syntax. Not complex because it's hard to hit command C for copy, but because you had to learn it, know it, remember it. Or you have to find it in a bunch of menus, then you click that command, then typically the next step is you have a dialog box that pops up on the screen. In this dialog box, you have a bunch of things you can fill out. So here, for example, I'm changing the size of the text. I made a very simple dialog box. And then when you're done, you click OK. And then your text changes the size. All right, it did. Yeah. I just converted the slides from PowerPoint to Keynote and some things. Don't work. So I hardly call this direct manipulation, right? I mean, to me, it's a complex syntax in the sense that I have to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 steps to get the result. Right? It's not incremental. I don't see what's happening until I click OK. It is reversible if the undo command exists and does what I think. But I'm not really interacting with that object. I mean, if I wanted to change the size of that object, I would want to be able to stretch it. So my point here is that the designers of graphical user interfaces that work in industry today and create interfaces you're using every day, they tend to confuse the fact that you are interacting with things on the screen with the concepts of direct manipulation. Every time you put a menu, every time you put a dialog box, every time you put a slider somewhere, you are creating indirect. And maybe it is a good thing, and maybe there are good reasons for doing it, but you should ask yourself, is there a better way? Can I have a more direct interaction that people will understand and use to attend? Now, that's not the only problem with direct manipulation. Another issue with direct manipulation comes back to the first principle that was on the screen there. Representation of the objects of interest. Now, that bears the question of what are the objects of interest? So, if you're editing text, well, of course, the object of interest is text. But text is a complicated thing. It has characters that make a word, that make sentences, that make paragraphs, that are organized in sections, maybe in chapters. So you have this whole structure. There are also cross-references in text. Maybe you have footnotes. Maybe you are citing something in a bibliography. Maybe you are referring to a previous section. So as an object of interest, text is already a complicated thing. And so what people have come up with to deal with this complexity is to introduce new concepts. And so in text editing, I'm sure you're all familiar with the notion of style. Yes? Okay. So how would you define a style? What's a style? So semantic class, what do you mean by semantic here?
It gives meaning to a part of the text. Like otherwise the text, like it's just raw text anyway. You may give a style to parts of it, but it doesn't mean something internally, or if it's a style you can assign the meaning is a part of the text.
So by meaning you can say this is a heading.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Would you agree with that question? Nobody cares. Nobody is asking themselves what the hell is the style. I would say I agree and I disagree. And I think a style, at the core, a style is just a collection of attributes. When you edit text, you can say, I want this piece of text bold, and I want this one in this different font, and I want this paragraph to have different margins, etc. Right? So these are all, in a sense, presentation attributes of text. Font size, maybe the color of text, whether it's underlined, margins of the paragraph, and margins of the... And the thing is, there are so many of these attributes that you want to group them together, and that is what's called a style. So that's the part where I was not agreeing directly with what you said. Now, it turns out that the reason we use style is indeed to emphasize semantic meaning of the text. If you want a line to be the title of a section, well, you would typically want it bold with a bigger font, maybe a different color, maybe a different font. But what counts is that, well, this is what headings look like. So that's where I agree with you that styles also represent the type of semantic meaning we want to attach to text, right? Now the thing is that, are you familiar with Microsoft Word?
Yes.
So you have styles in Word, right? And in fact, every document that you open comes with predefined style. They have a normal style. They have heading 1, heading 2, heading 3, etc., etc. But you can also create your own styles and give them names. You can modify the existing style to associate different attributes to a particular style, etc. So anybody who does a little bit of serious text editing with a tool like Word has to know what styles are, understand what they are, interact with them. And by interacting, I mean not just apply a style to a piece of text, but say, oh, I want to change the style because I don't like the way the lists is displayed or something. So I would say that styles in the text editing, in the word processing system, styles are objects of interest. Now I call them secondary objects of interest. The primary objects of interest is the text itself, because that's what the word processor is for. But you'll find in any serious piece of software that once you have this obvious or primary objects of interest, to facilitate interaction, to make it more powerful, you also need to know about other concepts that have been introduced by the designer. Where things, I think, break down badly in a tool like Microsoft Word is that even though they are objects of interest, they follow none of the principles we talked about before. You cannot see a style in Word. Well, you can see it in the list of styles, but I cannot... When I speak of objects of interest, it's really this idea that I can take this object and do what I want with it. And so, for example, if you have a document where there is, you know, the style of the section headings is a style that you want to reuse because you like it. There's no way to take the style to say, copy this style and paste it. I'm sure there is, by the way. I mean, in Word, there is a function for everything. Last I looked, it's in the thousands of them. But people don't know. In fact, we've studied professional users of word processors recently, they don't even know how to number lists. And I'm not kidding. Because there are professional users, but they're not professional users in the sense that their job is to use Word and to be expert at Word. There are professional users who write patents, who write contracts, so they are legal professionals who have to use this tool, and they decided that it was easier for them to do things by hand rather than become proficient and learn all the tricks to do clever numbering and things like this. And this is really bad because, for example, what we observed is that you take a contract. You've seen a legal contract, right? So typically it has articles in it. Article 1, Article 2, etc. They don't use numbering for that. So in the course of redacting the contract and editing it and modifying it, inevitably at some point they will insert a new article or remove one or swap two. And of course, articles refer to each other, right? But they don't use the referencing capability of Word. Have you used references in Word? Yeah? No? Yeah? Did you like it? I don't. They don't use that because they don't trust it. They don't trust. One of the big problems is that if you have created a numbered list and you want to reference that item, you insert a reference. Okay, let's assume you know how to do that. But then if the number rate changes because, again, you insert, delete, swap things, the references don't change. You have to update them by hand. And so you see things that you know are wrong. You need to do an extra step to fix it. And the end result is they just don't trust it, and they prefer doing it by hand. Now, I think these are good examples where something is wrong, not with the users, because that's a tendency of the editors of the software. Say, well, but I mean, those users are stupid. We put all the features in there. How come they're not using them? No, I think it's not something wrong with the users. It's something wrong with the designers. We didn't realize that what they were putting in the system was not usable by normal users. And the thing you have to always keep in mind is you are not normal users. You're here because you like computers. You like interacting with computers. You like to understand how computers work. Yes?
Yes.
Most people,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But most people don't. Most people, you know, a computer is like a tool. It's like a bike to go to work. You know, they don't want to, or a car. They don't want to understand how the engine works and all the tricks that it may have and all the features. They want to use it for their work and be efficient. And they're willing to learn. But nowadays, it's very discouraging to learn software because new versions coming every 6 months or every other morning if you have this. Subscription model, and things change all the time. So imagine you are learning the piano, right? And the keyboard and the piano change every 6 months. It's like, oh, we're going to add another black key here because we think it's cool. Are we going to swap the black and the white? Or I mean, you wouldn't be able to learn to be proficient in piano playing. And that's what's happening with software. Now, getting back to this, if we were thinking in terms of direct manipulation, we would say, well, okay, we're going to introduce this notion of style, but we want styles to become an object that the user can, in a sense, trust, and see, and manipulate, like other objects in the system. And so identifying the objects of interest is really important in that respect, in order to create an interface that make these objects first-class objects, as we say in computer speak. We'll get back to this in hopefully next week's lecture on instrument.interaction to show you how to do this in practice. Second problem was the way. The title here is a misnomer. It's not problems of direct manipulation per se. it's problems the of the interpretation of direct manipulation in current systems, I would say. The second problem is that we've introduced all these interface elements that make interactions less direct. Now, there's two ways to look at this. One is to say, these are bad and we need to get rid of them. And we want everything to be direct. Now, in the example I showed you at the beginning, I took a good example where I had an object that is a piece of text. I want to change the text size by stretching the object. That would be, to me, the most direct way of changing size. Well, that is fine for a feature that is visually represented. But if I wanted to change the font of that piece of text, what else can I do but somehow display a list of available fonts? I mean, not everything can be done directly. So I think the better approach is to say, well, you know, some things can be done super directly, some maybe a bit less, some we haven't found a way to make them direct, but be aware that we are introducing this level of indirection. And so in this class next week on instrumental interaction, we'll show that in fact we can make indirect interaction, but that is efficient and close to the way we interact in the physical world. So what I want to do in the rest of the lecture today is to go over sort of basic things that you already know, but to organize them in kind of taxonomy of what we call interaction tasks. Before we get to that, we need to start at what some people call the lexical level of interaction, but personally don't like this term, but sort of the low level of how we interact with graphical content. Now, here I'm talking mostly of techniques that work on typically laptops, interfaces where you have an indirect pointing device. And by the way, the mouse or the trackpad already create indirection, right? Because you're doing stuff on the table and it's happening on the screen, so it's not direct. But and so many of the techniques that I'll talk about rely on the fact that you have a cursor on the screen that you can control, and typically buttons to activate. In a touch-based interaction, you would have to revisit these things so they're adapted to direct touch. And just briefly, there are two big differences between touch and, say, mouse-based interaction. First one is the devices today that we have, they track the fingers only when they are touching the surface or very close to the surface. So you don't have a cursor. If your finger is away, there is no cursor on the screen. And that changes the type of interactions you can do. For example, on typical GUIs on a laptop, you're used to having tooltips. So if you put your cursor somewhere and you do nothing, for a while, the tooltip comes out to help. On the touch interface, you don't have a cursor that stays there. So either you have to bring the tooltip with a long press, or find another way. So the fact that you don't have a permanent cursor on the screen is a big, big difference in terms of the type of interaction you can do. And the failure of all touch interfaces before the iPhone was they did not recognize that. They just said, well, your finger is the cursor, but that's just not. The other big difference is that the cursor is small, the finger is big. So you're going to put your finger right on the thing that you want to interact with and hide it. So how do you deal with that? So there's a bunch of tricks on touch interfaces, but it's just to say that the difference that seems minor, because all the software stack above, all it needs to know is, you know, where is the pointing device, whether it's a finger or a cursor, seems to, you know, work in the two types of interfaces, but that's not true. And again, if you do a touch interface, and that would apply to other form of interactions like tangible, you need to rethink really from the very low level of the interaction. So in an interface where you have a cursor, you can provide feedback to the user about what the system interprets of the user's action. And as I've said before, feedback is super important, because with feedback, one tells you that the system is both understanding or reacting to what you're doing, and it improves the impression that you're interacting with real things. So a very simple level of feedback when you're doing pointing, and by pointing what I mean is just moving the cursor on the screen, the most basic thing you can do in this type of interface, is that depending on where you are, so here you're outside an object, here you're on the border of an object, here you are inside an object, you can have a subtle, should be subtle, you don't want things to flash, but a subtle change of, say, color will inform you of where you are. And if you're trying to point small objects like this border instead of this center, for example, this feedback is very important, because we are used to this feedback loop to adjust our gestures. Unfortunately, I'm talking about this because few interfaces actually do that properly. They tend to do, well, most of the time, not enough, meaning nothing, no particular feedback when you're pointing on things, or too much where things blink at you and are jarring. And it's very, and that's where the skills of a graphic designer can make a difference between something that's going to be subtle but effective and something that's going to be annoying. So the input techniques we use in graphical interaction, mouse-based interaction, is one, pointing, moving the cursor to show interest in an object. Second is selection, and that's clicking, right? Yeah, I know this looks so basic that it's probably boring, but have you looked in detail at what happens when you click on a button? It looks very simple. You click on the button, right? So you click on the button of the mouse. When the cursor is on the button on the screen, thank you for the vocabulary. That's very helpful to have the same word for different things. And you click the button. That's it. Well, but a lot of stuff can happen in that simple action. First, as you know, we can interact with a single click. We can do a double click, triple, quadruple. I don't know that people have done beyond four. So how do we distinguish two clicks from one double click? How close? Well, how close is what to what? Immediately, yes. Yes. Between what and what? What's a click? A half. Is it a press or is it a click? Is a click a press? I think a click is more a press. Henry?
I thought click was a sound.
Click was a sound, you're right. You're absolutely right. But by extension, the sound is produced by pressing and releasing.
It's two sounds.
It's two sounds. And by the way, we still call it a click. So, so to have a click, you need button down and button up. And then you have a second button down, button up. So you can measure at least four different time differences between the first down and the last up, between the first up and the second down, between which one is it? Yes, we'll get to that in a second. So
that depends on how this is mind who you're targeting, you know, if you're targeting people that have motion problems, you might want to double click to be way longer than it would be for maybe somebody without blood.
It doesn't really matter.
No, it doesn't really matter if you're taking the click down and then click off,
well,
click down, click down. You just have to have a gift of time.
Okay. I'll push that a little bit. So when your mouse is on the button like this, you're going to start by pressing. So should there be feedback when you press? Yes. And here what I showed is typically it highlights in some way. Okay. Now, say this is the OK button for a print dialog. When does the printing start? When I release, not when I button down. Yes? When you release, okay, majority opinion? Yes? Well, as far as I know, that's what happens most of the time. But what can happen between you press and you release? You may move. So you can press here, then you move outside of the button and release, and what happens? Yes? Welcome. I hope there is a chair. Yeah, here. It cancels the action. Now, complicated matters, we can sometimes have objects that react not just to the click, but also to the fact that you can move them. So you can start dragging. So with the mice or touch pads we have nowadays, which are very sensitive, I can guarantee you that between button down and button up, no matter how good you are, there will be a tiny move. So how do you know when you start really moving and when it was just a click? Now, yes? You hold? Okay, so that's that gets into the long click kind of thing. My point here is, for something that seems that obvious, as obvious as a button press, there are many decisions to make that have to do with timeouts, when, how do I measure the differences between successive clicks. One issue with this timing between successive clicks is that if I've done one click, by definition, I don't know yet if another is coming. So, if we imagine that, you know, clicking once on this OK button, this is a silly example, then one thing, but a double click on that OK button does something else. I don't know, maybe a single click prints for real on the printer, and the double click prints the PDF. Very stupid and bad design. Stay with me. Now, when I'm done with my first click, I don't know yet if the second is coming, right? So I need to wait. And then I'm in trouble because I want immediate reaction from the system, show that it's reacting. But here, in order to enable double click, I need to wait until I know. And so it's all these microscopic decisions that can have a big impact on the usability of your system. Now, a good practice is that the double click action should always be an extension, to do something on top of what the single click would do. Because that means that you can do the single click action no matter what on the first button up. And then if it turns out to be a double click, you do something on top of it. And if you look at selecting icon in the Finder-like interface, you do a single click, you select the icon. If you do a double click, you open it. But no, in fact, you select and then open. So the select could happen immediately, and then the second one will open. Right? And so in building following these principles of direct manipulation, of being fast incremental, raises all these small details of interaction. So, pointing, selection, the last basic action we have in graphical user interfaces is dragging, moving the cursor with one or more buttons pressed. And so you're all familiar with the fact that while you're doing this, you want some feedback to happen. So you can see the ghost of the object or the object itself move. So here's a move, here it's a resize. And again, that's the fast interactive action. See what is going to happen. And here the key is to have something that is reactive. If the redisplay you have to do to show the feedback or show the action takes too much time, your system is going to feel sluggish, and people will make mistakes and will be frustrated. So for many years, before computers were as powerful as they are today, when we moved objects on the screen, we didn't move the real window, we didn't move the real icon, it moved only an outline. Right? And it's only when they became powerful enough that it made sense to move the exact image to create a better sense of interacting with the physical object, but it had to be done with good enough refresh rate. So that's what we call the drag interaction, or familiar with drag and drop and all that. As I mentioned before, there is this interaction between the two interaction techniques of just clicking to select and dragging, and typically you want to build in some thresholds there. So if I have the button down long enough, as you were mentioning, then it's going to start the drag, or if I've moved enough, it's going to start the drag. The last basic interaction there with the mouse is inking, where you are leaving a trace of the trajectory that you're covering with the mouse. So if you want a pen drawing interface, for example. In dragging, all that counts for the drag is where you started, where you ended. Whichever trajectory you followed, as you know, does not affect the result. With inking, which can be used for gesture input as well, then of course the trajectory is important. So here we've established the sort of basic vocabulary of graphical interaction with these three actions: pointing, selection, and dragging or inking. And so now we can turn to the next level up, which is once we have this basic vocabulary, how can we assemble all these things together with visual objects to support basic tasks? So this listing of tasks here is a revised version of a taxonomy originally presented by James Foley back in the 80s, so it's pretty old. I added a couple of tasks here that became standard interfaces since then. And my argument is you can deconstruct any graphical user interface in terms of this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 basic tasks. As an input task, you need to put stuff in the computer that was not there before. So there are selection tasks when you need to pick something among the number of things that were already in there. There are trigger tasks where you want to say do this. There are navigation tasks where you want to get to content that is not currently available. There's property setting tasks where you want to, well, set properties and attributes of objects. And transformation task is a specific type of property task that can be done by proper direct manipulation. So what I'm going to do is to go over this different task and show the types of basic interactions that are available today to support these tasks. Input. So input task is task where you need to input information in the computer that the computer did not have. So creating a new file, a new document, you need to save the document. You need to give it a name. Well, the system can guess a name for you and make a suggestion, and, I don't know, based on the first line of the text. But if that's not what you want, you need to enter the name that you want. So it's an input task. Sometimes you need to specify a value. I want to have text of particular size. So the input tasks are classified in terms of the type of data you're entering. Are you entering text? Are you entering a single numerical value? Are you entering a 2D position, which could be done by pointing and 2D space? Are you inputting a trace where you want to sample a particular gesture to have a sequence of positions? The thing with input tasks is that they are always specific to that input type. And oftentimes, designers are lazy and they use these basic techniques here to enter more complex data. So I'll take a simple example here. Say you have a button in an interface to create a table. And the system needs to know the size of the table, and by size I mean the number of columns and the number of rows. Now, what you will find in most interfaces, when you have this type of input task, entering data the system does not have, is, well, you're going to pop up the dialog box and say, enter the number of rows, enter the number of columns, click OK, and there you go. So here, we've substituted the input task of entering table size by two input tasks for entering numbers, plus a trigger task, say, OK, do it. I think there is a better way. And in fact, in Microsoft Word, or at least some version, because I don't keep track of this, but when you click on that button, you would have a pop-up with this grid, and you could directly drag into this grid to select here a 3x4, which is what I had specified on the right here, or drag further. This thing would expand as you go. It would display at the bottom the size, and so you would have more direct manipulation way of entering these two numbers. It's not completely direct manipulation because you're doing this in a pop-up on the screen. You're not doing it inside your document. Okay, but at least it gives you a better visual sense of where you're doing. The other important thing about input tasks is that you want to give users the choice. And this interface is fine if you're creating a small table. If it's a really big one, it's going to be a bit more tedious. And if you know in advance that it's going to be a 10 by 15 table, you prefer that one on the right. But with the one on the left, you could say, well, maybe this part at the bottom is editable, and I can type here the size or something. Provide alternatives because people have different ways of working and different contexts of use. Always forcing to go back to the basic inputs from dialog boxes should be avoided. And you should think of better input technique depending on the type of data you ask the user to input. Now, why do we see more of this type of dialog box and less of this type of direct manipulation input? Why? Here? For the user? Yeah. You know the mistake I always do with the one on the right? I flip rows and columns. I don't know, I'm probably dyslexic or something. So, I mean, you're right, there's no perfect technique, and people will make mistakes with this one as well, or will be frustrated, or find it annoying, or whatever. Now, why is it that people often, the developers and the designers, often end up with this type of things? It's because it's easier. You know, with today's development tools, it's super easy to put together a dialog box like this. If you want to design the thing on the left, you have to program it, you know, from scratch. That takes time. And people don't realize that maybe they're going to spend 2 days of their time to implement this properly, and the company will think it's a waste of money. Not thinking that this could save millions of hours of the time of people who can use this thing every day and, you know, spend more time using the dialog box on the right than this one on the left. So imagine the number of times you do simple actions in the word processor. It's maybe hundreds of times a day multiplied by millions of people. So if I can save 1 second on a thing like this, I save multiple people's lives. I think. Anyway, so input. The second category of tasks is called, unfortunately, selection tasks. I say unfortunately because I already used the word selection for the click earlier. Now, selection task is a task where information is already in the computer, but you need to pick among a set of possibilities. And that's something we do again and again and again. Right? In fact, most of the time, we select from existing possibilities rather than enter something from scratch. And in fact, there are a number of techniques that you all know very well to address this selection task. Now, if you're to pick something among a set of possibilities, we can think of two criteria that are relevant. One is the set of possibilities always the same, or is it going to change over time? So if the set of possibilities is, I don't know, the list of countries in the world, you know this pop-up that comes up when you fill out forms and has a long list of countries. Well, the list of countries, it does change over time, but it's pretty stable. But if you're going to change, choose a file among the set of files on your hard drive, that changes a lot more. So, is the list static or mostly static or dynamic, or fixed or variable size, as I put it here? The second important criteria is what is the size of this set? Whether I'm choosing between aligning left, center, or right, where I have three options, or among a list of countries, which there are what, about 200 these days-ish, or the entire set of web pages in the world, which is in the billions. Presumably, the same technique is not going to work for all three cases. So, there are techniques to that work well with fixed or designed, even, I would say, for fixed or mostly fixed size sets, and for sets that are small to maybe medium size, but rather small, these are menus, checkboxes, and radio buttons. So radio button, I'm selecting one out of a set. With checkboxes, I can select multiple ones in a set. And with the menu, I also can change one among the set of possibilities. So if you all know that, nothing much to say. Well, we'll say more about menus in a minute. So that's easy. When the set is variable, it's more complicated. So typically, you deal with variable sets when you select icons among your files, or you select in the list. And that list is brought to you, may change from one time to the next. And so therefore, to facilitate finding stuff in the list, it's typically organized, usually alphabetically, if it's set. However, what have you observed if you have, say, again, this example of the list of countries? You always have like the entire list of countries that starts with A and ends with Z. Yes? Exactly. Yes? Have you observed that? Okay. So, yes. So the idea is that when the list becomes longer and longer, getting, you know, to the bottom of the list is going to take time. So if we can, as you said, you know, guess or estimate what is your most likely choices, you can replicate them. Usually they stay in the list, but they're also at the top because things are easier to select if they're at the top than if they are way down. Now, another thing you can do with those lists is type. If you know what you're looking for, you can start typing and it will get you to that list. And so here, what we're doing is we're using a we are using an input technique. I'm typing the text for selection. And that's what makes this analysis of the basic test a little bit tricky, is that you can use an input for selection. You can also sometimes use selection for an input task. Like if you have when you edit text, you have a menu with a number of sizes, of text sizes, but it doesn't have all the numbers from 1 to 200. It has, you know, it's going to have the small ones until 10, then it goes 10, 12, 14, and then, I don't know, 18 and 26. So it has a subset. But next to it, there's a text box where you can enter your whichever number you want, but this menu is for quick access, or quicker access to what they estimate are frequent sizes. So here we're using selection for input, and the example with the list of countries, we use input for selection. But it's important to, you know, make sense of this when you design the interface. So entering text. And so when you start entering text to select in the list, I don't know if you've noticed, but again, there's a lot of tricky stuff. How does it do to decide that, you know, I'm starting to type FRA for France, but then I stop and I start typing something else, so it has to reset. So there's here again a timer that says, well, you know, if you haven't typed for some time, it's... And that, again, is all these little things that make the things feel right or feel wrong. And it takes a lot of trial and error to get these things right. I have to say, most of the time, they are done wrong, especially on the web, where people all reinvent things from scratch. So that was selection in larger lists. When the set becomes very large, you're not going to go with the linear list of 2,000 entries. So then we get into other things I'm not covering here, which is how to organize the list hierarchically, for example, so you can navigate a hierarchy of sections to get to the data. The other aspect of selection tasks is that in the easy case, you only need the user to select one element among a set. So once you've selected the element, you're done. It becomes more complicated if you want to support multiple selections, selecting multiple objects in the set. Because you are going to want to do this efficiently, but also give the flexibility to the user to say, well, you know, I'm starting with the set, and then I want to add stuff and remove stuff, and etc. So typically what you find in current interfaces, it's three big techniques for multiple selection, and three techniques that are not necessarily exclusive from each other. So the one is by grouping the items. So for example, in the Finder, you can do rectangular selection. You can select everything that's in the rectangle. Although here, too, there are questions. What does it need to be in the rectangle? You know, if I go a little bit further here and I overlap this a little bit, is it in there? I probably want not to, but if I have most of it but not the last little bit, I probably want it to be in, so it's not, you know, whether it's to the inside or to the outside, it's something in between. So again, details you may want, if you have depending on the interface, you want maybe to select with what's called a lasso to circle around objects. And as soon as you do this visual selection of a group of objects, you have this problem of what to consider inside or outside, because it's not a purely geometric inclusion that counts visually. In the list, you have, and that's a bit similar to this one, but it's selection by interval. You select the first one, the last one, and everything in between is selected. So that's fast, but doesn't work all the time. And so the most flexible one is a technique where you select one or more objects with these techniques, and then you want to pick and choose. I want to add this one, I want to remove this one. So what do you do for this, typically?
Drag?
Yeah, control click or shift click, or there are different modifiers, which already puts that in the category of stuff for experts. Because most people are not even aware that you have these powerful control keys. Yeah. So with the command or control key, depending on your platform, you can add or remove objects one by one. Another approach that you sometimes see, which has the advantage of really showing what you have selected, because if you have a long list that you have to scroll, you don't necessarily see all the selections. So here you use two lists, the full list of choices, and to the right the list of choices you have currently selected. And you can sometimes drag from one to the other, or you have arrows in the middle, or sometimes just a single click in one list will put it in the other, and double click will put it there, and double click on the right will put it to the left. So you sort of, you know, pick and choose what you want. Of course, it's much slower to do this, and so that's why you want to combine the different techniques, which you can also combine with a keyboard input to make navigating the list faster. Now, I said that a common technique that is used for selection tasks is the menu. So a menu is a list of choices, and we know of many different types of menus. Okay. So I'm sure you all know the menu bar and what we call the pull-down menus. Okay. Now this is a particular case of a hierarchical menu system. So you also know the hierarchical menu, where an item in the menu can bring a sub-menu with more items, you can go down and down. The menu bar is, in fact, a horizontal menu with the second level vertical menus. So hierarchical menus and menu bar are the same sort of family. Now, since we are on the hierarchical menus here, when you want to go to a submenu, especially when you have multiple submenus, you probably observe differences depending on the path you're following in the menu. Right? So typically, you go to this menu, the submenu appears, and you know that the item you want to go to is here. So what is your reflex? You're here, and you're going there. You want to go there. And then what happens in a poorly designed interface? Right. As you get out of the menu item here, on your way to where you want to go, it decides, oh, you changed your mind, so I'm going to disappear the menu, and the thing disappears from the menu piece. And once again, this is not taking into account basics about human control of motion, human expression of their intentions. If I'm here and I'm moving fast to this direction, don't remove the menu. And again, it's going to be a subtle setting, because of course if I move downwards slowly, or if I move down and stops, I do want to get to that other menu item. And not doing a shortcut. That's one of the things that annoys me the most on websites, is that this design of going to submenus has been, you know, fixed long ago in the graphical user interfaces of native applications. But on the web, where people have been re-implementing these things by hand, it's been done poorly time and again. It's getting better, but there are still many bad examples of hierarchical menus. So we all know about menu bars, hierarchical menus. You also all know about pop-up menus or contextual menus we typically come up with. Pop-up, boom. A menu that comes out of nowhere, how do you call it up? Yes. Right click. Okay. I'm worried. You have right clicks once in your life. Yes. Okay, good. So the other menus I was talking about there, or especially the menu bar, you see the menu bar, so the menu is there and you know where it is and you can go to the control, the text menu, contextual menu, pops up where you click. And so it's not there, but it's there. So you need to know that if you right-click, something is going to happen. The advantage of the pop-up menu is that the menu can be different depending on where you click. That's, in fact, one of the main points for it. The other advantage of the context menu is that it pops up where your cursor is. So you don't have to navigate to the top of the window or the top of the screen to say, this is the menu I want. You have it right there. And I mentioned last time, I believe, Fitts' law very briefly, the movement time. If the menu is there, it's going to be faster. And so you have this trade-off between, well, the menu is there, but the user has to know that there's a menu there, and putting the menu in plain sight, so it will take more time, but at least it will be discoverable. Now, there's another type of menu that maybe you don't see as menu, but they serve exactly the same function, are the tool palettes, or the text palettes that you have in many systems, right on the screen or at the top, where instead of words, typically you have icons, and it's the same thing, you select an object in it. Now, these palettes typically are fixed, like, say, the menu bar, and they are, and when you select, the object stays selected until you select another one. The last type that I have on this slide here is something that you probably don't know. I don't know. You tell me. It's what's called a pull-up menu. So I was saying before, you know, the menu bar, you know where it is, but it's a long way to get there. The contextual menu, it's right there, but you have to know that you can bring it up. So can we sort of combine these two things? Well, pull-off menus came up first in on the Macintosh and HyperCard, I think around 1986. Mac came out in 84, HyperCard was a year or two later. And so they had a menu called Tools that contained a little tool palette like this. And what happened is that if you click that menu and move the mouse quickly, the menu was torn off, pulled off the menu bar, and became a floating little window that you could bring next to where you were working, and then you had a palette, a fixed menu, fixed palette, next to your work area. And if you closed that thing, the menu was still available at the top. So this is the best of both worlds. The problem with a fixed palette like this is that it takes time on the screen all the time. Sometimes, you know, you want more space. So with the pull-off menu, we have an entry in the menu bar, which only, you know, I mean, the menu bar takes whatever space it takes, but the menu itself doesn't take space until you call it up. If you just need to select once in a while, you can go to that menu, but if you know you're going to use it intensively, you can pull it off and turn it into a floating palette. Yes?
I know.
And how many of you have seen this pull-off menus ever before? Whoa. Okay. I'm surprised, because usually a lot of people. So in what type of application have you seen those? Adobe?
Unity?
Unity. Yeah, they don't come off the menu bar, they come off the tool palette, right? But they don't come with a, you don't,
you can pull it off too.
Okay. I've stopped using Adobe for
older version of
Yes, because as usual, Microsoft did it wrong. Sorry. Now, the thing is, there has been, to be clear, there has been version of this where you pull the menu and there is a little something somewhere that you can click to detach it, which is different from what's happening here where People discover this by accident most of the time, by wanting to do something quickly, and they realize, oh, that thing pops up, and that's cool. And it has a very physical sense to it. Whereas I've seen versions of this in other systems where you needed to, there was a little separator between the title of the menu and the rest of the menu, and if you tap there, then it detaches, and I don't know, it's not satisfying. So, I'm glad to see that a lot of you have seen that. So, just to be clear, in Unity or Adobe, do you really detach by pulling them off?
Yeah, in Illustrator you can pull from a palette.
We're talking tool palettes.
Yeah.
Because I know you do that for the little control windows, the inspectors.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another story. Anyway, I'm curious. Oh yes, because the prime with the fixed palette that you can drag it to be close to your work area, that's fine. But if it's always there, then you know what happens if you get rid of it. And the prime is if you get rid of it, you don't see where it is, and it's hard to find it again. So to me, the thing I want to emphasize here is just that. You have the fact that it's standing in a menu that you can find. Then you can bring, in fact, what you're bringing is a copy of that. You're not really, it's still, that menu is still there, but you're bringing a fixed copy of it. And when you're done with it, you can close it, and you know it's still there in the menu. So that's and again, all these are, may look like little details, but they make a big difference in usability. Of course, as I've said before, the ability of humans to adapt to anything is both our strength and the weakness, because people get used to poor interfaces, and then when you change it for a better one, you say, oh, but no, I liked it better before. And there's this cost of adapting to things. So there's been a lot of poor designs historically. So there was, since we were with Microsoft, another thing they did at some point, and I think it was around XP actually. No, it was before. Anyway, doesn't matter. They did these menus where the menu would show all the options for some time, and then after a while, based on its statistics on your using or not using some commands, the menu would shrink. And suddenly, you know, you find yourself like a feature has disappeared. And that was a trick, it was some kind of long click or something to get it to show you the entire thing. Now the thing that I find absolutely stunning about this is there have been published studies, published papers by the very Ben Schneiderman, in fact, that we mentioned earlier, that had shown, because that's a natural idea, right? If someone is not using a feature, make it, you know, less visible or something. So he had studied that, and he had found and demonstrated that users don't like it, and it makes them slower. Because users like stability. I don't like my menus to change because the system thinks that I'm going to use this or not use that. What Schneiderman had shown was that the right alternative was to say, well, keep the menu as it is, don't touch it, but put the most frequent ones at the top, like we talked about before, the list of countries, right? And that works. I'm sorry?
As long as it's a copy of the menu.
Yeah, as long as it's a copy, absolutely. Replicate the most frequent ones at the top. And so the fact that a company like Microsoft, but you know, Apple has done similar things, and everybody, ignore the published literature in that way and put something in that then they have to take out because it's, they realize that it doesn't work when the science was already there, is frustrating. Now, this whole idea of putting stuff at the top of the menu that is most frequently used is, well, why is that? Why would we do that?
To be quicker.
To be quicker, of course, because, you know, if I want to click the first or second or third item, they're much closer to where I click to bring the menu in the first place, whether it's a pull-down menu or a context menu. And the first items are closer, so faster to get to than the one further down the list. This is Fitts' law at its best. But what if we put the items in the menu in a circle? So this is called the pie menu, invented by Don Hopkins around 1982, I believe. And so it's called pie menu because it looks like pie slices. So here you click to bring the menu up, and then every item is at the same distance. In fact, selection is by direction rather than by distance. And we're not exactly equally good at doing gestures in all directions, but pretty close. So selection is faster because all the items are at the same distance. You can have submenus, so I go into that slice of the pie, and then another pie menu can come up center there, so I can do hierarchical pie menus. The problem, of course, is that if you know, like every pie, if you need more slices, they're going to be smaller. So if you need 20 slices, it's going to be very tiny parts, and it's going to be harder and harder to select. Now, studies have shown that 8 items in the menu is actually one where we can be very, very efficient. Typically 3 times faster than one regular menu. How many of you have seen pie menus or used pie menus? Okay, pure hands. In what application?
With the new Microsoft thing for the surface.
Okay. What kind of?
Well, the object is in the middle of the pie menu, so
yeah, okay. And they're around. Okay. Video games, yes. In fact, Don Hopkins went to work for Electronic Arts, and The Sims were the first application with real pie menus. You raise your hands too?
Yeah, I was thinking like city builders.
The Sims?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's because the guy was there.
Yeah,
I don't remember the name, but it comes from.
Okay.
The pie menu, is it selecting something inside the circle or it denotes itself something? For example, if you click the right click, if you make a right click and find the property, it will show the space of your folder. It's more or less like a pie menu.
Yes.
Is that it?
So the fundamental idea of the pie menu is that if you lay out the choices in a circle, you need to select them by direction rather than in the linear menu where you need to go, you know, a certain distance. And the further you go, the harder it is, and the more time it takes. So the pie menu originally had this shape. Now I'm going to get to marking menus, which is a variant where the display is a bit different. But when you have a circular arrangement of things, you can say it's a pie menu. Now, Gordon Kurtenbach, in his thesis in 93, improved pie menus with what he called marking menus. Now, there's a whole controversy around this because Don Hopkins said that he already had this feature in his pie menus. But I guess we can at least give credit to Kurtenbach for having really done in-depth studies of marking menus, and then done a lot of more work to apply them in practice. In fact, Kurtenbach then moved to company called Alias Wavefront that is now Autodesk. And Maya, which is a very well-known 3D modeler, was probably the biggest, I don't want to say the first because it's always dangerous to say the first, but a very large, well-known application, professional application that used marketing menus. Although in the beginning, the marketing at Alias Wavefront were not so sure, so they left the regular menus, and then they also had the marketing menus. And it turns out that when they looked at what people were using, those who had discovered the marketing menus were really sticking with them because they are so much more efficient. So the marketing menu is essentially the same idea as here, except the display is a bit different. In the top one here, you see you have the menu is using a lot of space. And since it's a context menu, again, you have this problem that that your fingers and touch interfaces, it hides the very thing you're trying to interact with. So the marketing menus third thing is that it's not easy to write text in those slices. So in marketing menus, the text are in this labels here. There is a star shape in the middle to show where the slices are, but you don't have to go in the little rectangles to select. Any slice here will do the selection. So seen from the mouse, it works exactly as the regular pie menus, but visually it has this layout which doesn't hide as much content. So that's the first difference, and it is makes the thing a lot easier to use. The second thing is, if you do the gesture quickly, the menu does not even display. And that's really a key finding to make this transition from what we call novice users, but it's also intermittent users who just tap or click and wait till the menu appears to make their choice. But if they know where the menu item is, they can do the gesture quickly, and the menu itself doesn't display. Typically, when you release the button, this works also with pen interface, which is also a big advantage. It's both touch and mouse. So when you lift the finger, it flashes the command you selected as a feedback. This is brilliant because, in fact, you don't have to learn a shortcut. With a linear menu, you can point in the linear menu blindingly. If you know where the item is, you're going to anticipate and go there, but you need the display to make sure that you're selecting the right one. With a pie menu of 8 items in particular, but could go probably to a bit more than that, or this one are 6. But say until 8 items, you can select a direction out of 8 blindingly with no problem. And what we see here is that it works in the hierarchical menu. So I can select the northeast item here and then go east to select, this would be for an 8 item menu, the one on the right. So by doing gestures, and people learn gestures at 2 and even 3 levels, it's super fast. And if at some point you don't remember, you pause and the menu appears and then you know where you're going. Now this has been shown by control experiment to work up to 3.5 times faster than a regular menu. There are no patents on it. So why on earth are we not all using marketing menus on regular interfaces? I mean, in HCI, having a technique that is 3.5 times faster is, I mean, you don't get those. I mean, you're happy when you get 10% improvement, 20% maybe. A few techniques we'll talk about, twice as fast, but 3.5 times, you never get it. So what's the problem? Now, one problem with marketing menus is it works with small menus. So we are used in our applications to have menus that are longer and longer and longer. And you know, every new release of a software is going to say, oh, we have 150 new features. Every time you'll see the menus are longer. So if you want to design a system for marketing menus, you're going to have to think and organize your features and make choices about what goes where and how we organize things so that they can fit that. But I can guarantee you that, you know, the 150 items that I think I counted recently in a version of a popular word processor, people don't use them. So thinking about, okay, what is the set of features we would put in a set of marketing menus that are really the ones that are the most critical, it could save hundreds and hundreds and millions of hours a day people will use this tool. So here's a short video of marketing menus. There's sound.
For example, I'll do a selection from a linear menu. I'll select tools, hammer. I'll do that same selection as fast as I can. It took me about a second and a half. Now I'll do the same selection with a marking menu. I'll select tools, followed by hammer. Let me show you that again. Tools, hammer. That took me about the same length of time. Now I'll do the same selection with a mark. That took me about 0.3 seconds. I'll show you that again, this time drawing the mark fast. That took me about 0.2 seconds. So you can see you can get up to a 10 times speed up using a marking menu mark over a linear menu. Let me demonstrate the use of gesture recognition and scale independence in marking menus. First, let's look at a typical implementation of radial menus. In this case, a pie style of menu display is used. For example, I'll select tools, cross the submenu border, and then select hammer. Let me show you that again. I'll select tools, and then hammer. The implementation does not support scale independence. Note, if I do the same movements but at a larger scale, I get the wrong selection or I get no selection. And if I do the same movements but at a smaller scale, I get a different selection. Now I'll show you the same selection for a marking menu using menu mode. I pop up the menu, select tools, followed by hammer. Note when selecting both menus, my movements are scale independent. I can make large movements, or I can make small movements. They both result in the same selection. If the user doesn't wait for the menu to pop up, mark mode is engaged and a gesture recognizer is used. For example, I'll do the same selection with the mark. Note that I can do a small gesture or a large gesture in a very loose and casual way. In contrast with pie menus, I have to carefully control the size of my movement to get the right selection. Also note that flashing menus are much more visually taxing than the stationary ink trail of the mark.
Okay. Are you convinced?
Yeah.
So this comparison with pie menus was really to answer John Hopkins' claim that, you know, he had the gesture menu already, and what Kurtenbach contributed was this scale independence. Because when you do gestures quickly, in particular, you know it's right and down or right and top left. You don't pay attention to the scale. In the original marking menus, you had to be within the circle to do the right selection, so it didn't have the scale independence. But you said in the beginning that, you know, you can go from 1 second and a half to 0.2 seconds just by doing the thing faster, without realizing that you've learned to do it. And in fact, a number of people, when they transition to the expert mode, they don't even realize that the menu didn't show up because the thing did what they wanted. So I think that's a great example of a really clever and efficient technique, and it's really a shame that it's not used more often. Last point, and then we're going to take a break, I guess. Yes? There are many ways of doing selection tasks. This is a screenshot from a very old Macintosh interface. This is probably Photoshop as it was at the time. So you have a tool palette that, you know, we've seen in many tools. But here there were many ways of selecting things among a set of options, like here a list with icons and names and the scroll bar to navigate it. Here was to change the screen background. You had these little arrows to navigate the set of predefined backgrounds. This is radio buttons. This is the volume where you can see it as a choice among, you know, seven different levels. The little clock here, you would click on the number and you'd have the little arrows again to go up and down. And this one was to select the size of some memory cache, where you also had these little arrows, but you could type the number, etc. And so you have all these different ways, and I think this interface illustrates that, again, if you customize the technique to the particular things you want to get access to, and if it's done properly, it's going to be more efficient. And the fact that today we always rely on the same basic basic widgets to do the same thing again and again, it's sold on the idea that, well, it's consistent, everybody knows how it works. Yes, but it's also very inefficient. And so most of the interfaces we build today are not really following the fourth item in the direct manipulation principles of helping people to get better at it. You know, you use your, this is something that Wendy says all the time, you know, how much time a day do you spend on your smartphone? Okay, don't be shy, admit it.
6 hours.
What?
6 hours.
6 hours. Yeah, well, okay. So it's in, you know, at least an hour. I heard a number of people say an hour, right? Now, how many of you practice an instrument, a musical instrument? Okay. Now, if you play whatever instrument you play, the piano, the guitar, the violin, the whatever, 1 hour a day, you would get better at it, right? So do you think you are better at it today with your smartphone than you were 6 months ago? No. Let's take a break and ponder on that instrument.